Yeah, we seem to be assembled and audible, I take it. Mm-hmm. So we begin. It is obviously something new. We had a long time over the Cyclops chapter, and you will see this is, as always from now on, entirely different. It has a softer tone. It doesn't have this rough, vulgar speech thing, and it's probably, and it was like given over to female to actresses rather than a man's voice. There are two things to be said here. One is that when Ulysses, as it was then in 1920, as it was then, was publicized in a little review in New York for Chicago, this issue, and the chapters weren't quite as developed as they are now, this issue was confiscated because some father had sued the editors that it was obscene material, and there was a court case. And of course, if at that time you could prove that anything in a book is obscene, if it's only a small thing, you don't hear? If it's only a small thing, the book could not be published. And so the editors were fined and the publication was stopped, which meant, the English and American law being what it is, that no other court could accept the book, and it was impossible for it to be printed and published in the British Commonwealth or the United States. And so Joyce was at the dead end and stopped. Until in Paris at the party, he met a young woman, Sylvia Beach, who had a bookshop in Paris, Shakespeare and Company. And she said, would he allow her to publish it? And he accepted. And so the book could come out. Now in France, the law was different. The law was different, and they didn't know English anyway, so he could get away with it. The catch was that the French typesetters didn't know English except for one person, and that was a good thing because they made mistakes. But you can always correct mistakes. I've done this for a long time in my life. But the French typesetters were not likely to normalize what he wrote, to put it presumably correct. The oddities they didn't notice. And so then it came out in an expensive way. The other thing is, a private thing, when Joyce was in Zurich, living at Universitätsstrasse 29, that is Haldenbach. The house is still there. He must have seen in the streets or from his window or both a young woman by name of Marthe Fleischmann. He spoke to her, it seems, and he wrote a few letters. He had a kind of correspondence. The correspondence was in French. Here you see a picture of her as she was then, Martha Fleischmann. The correspondence was in German. She didn't know English and French. So something, I don't know what you, that went on some time. And then the man who obviously lived with this Martha Fleischmann interfered, and Joyce was scared. And we don't know what happened. What did happen is that Joyce wrote her several, we have four in existence, not in the foundation, but in copies. She wrote her very sentimental love letters, awful kitsch, which is very strange. Not that, of course, the old generation would like to have their love letters published.
Don't hear a word.
But the others hear something. Can you perhaps come in again or something?
I hear quite well.
Yeah, the others seem to.
Maybe a computer again.
You wouldn't understand it, of course. Mm-hmm.
How many are listening? Can hear?
Okay. Now, well, the others can hear. I understand. Otherwise, you would. Wait. Yeah.
Yes.
Good.
Yes, we can hear. We can hear. I think it's Ursula's problem.
Uh-huh.
Ursula, okay. You have to fix it your end, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Ursula, maybe start the computer again.
Of course, if you don't hear, you don't hear the advice.
I write her.
No, please do, yeah. Anyway, where was I? Oh, yeah. And he wrote her in Kitsch. And it's interesting that in this first half of the new chapter, it's that kind of language that he, as a man, wrote to a woman who probably didn't care a lot, that he used the same kind of kitsch type of style. Mm-hmm. But he inverted it and projected it onto her. We also know that they had one meeting in a studio, that Frank Burgin had, painter, and that Joyce went out with a woman and came back, and we don't know what happened. No idea what happened. It's shrouded in history. Anyway, there is a psychological basis in Zurich. That's right. Good. And of course, you can read the letters in the books. Okay, now we start with the first paragraph.
The summer evening had begun to fold the world in its mysterious embrace. Far away in the west, the sun was setting, and the last glow of all too fleeting day lingered lovingly on sea and strand, on the proud promontory of dear old Hoth, guarding as ever the waters of the bay, on the weed-grown rocks along Sandymount shore, and last but not least, on the quiet church, whence there streamed forth at times upon the stillness the voice of prayer to her who is in her pure radiance a beacon ever to the storm-tossed heart of man, Mary, star of the sea.
I hear to my disappointment that it is a male actor who reads it all. It would be more suitable, but there we are. This is the first chapter that begins with a female note. We'll see that. And what we have here is what we do not have at the beginning. We have an exposition. We know where we are. It's all there. Whereas in the first chapter, it takes a long time to find out where we were. And it's summer evening. We began with a summer morning, and then a summer evening had begun to fold the world in its mysterious embrace. Now you might ask, do summer evenings embrace a mysterious world? Not really, but of course you can say it. It's a kind of tradition, and we've heard things like that before, and it's quite agreeable, harmonious and sweet, perhaps a bit too. And you can see there's now one long, beautiful sentence that tells us where we are. Far away in the west, the sun was setting. That's what it does. And remember, first Bloom chapter, he walked towards the east. And the last glow of all too fleeting day lingered lovingly on sea and strand. On the proud promontory of dear old Hoth, so we know where we are, we see the hill of Hoth, as we saw it in the morning in the background, guarding as ever the waters of the bay, but the hill is personified. He's guarding, he's doing something. on the weed-grown rocks along Sandy Mount shore. And now we know we're in Sandy Mount. And you may remember we were in Sandy Mount before. That's where Stephen was in the third chapter, where he was walking. And there he also saw the weed-grown rocks and all of that. So we are in the same place. And last but not least, and you know, nowadays it's better if you don't say last but not least. We've heard it too often a little bit. On the choir church, whence there streamed forth at times, upon the stillness, the voice of prayer to her who is in a pure radiance, a beacon ever to the storm-tossed heart of man, Mary, Star of the Sea. And in Sandy Mount, that is on the coast, a bit south of Dublin, there is in fact a church, Star of the Sea. The Virgin Mary is called the Star of the Sea, Stella Maris. And of course, the storm-tossed heart of man, it's Odysseus who was storm-tossed. So you see, we have that kind of beautiful but very traditional introduction, different from the morning. Good, then we go on.
The three girlfriends were seated on the rocks, enjoying the evening scene and the air, which was fresh but not too chilly. Many a time and oft were they wont to come there to that favourite nook to have a cosy chat beside the sparkling waves and discuss matters feminine. Sissy Caffrey and Edie Boardman with the baby in the pushcar, and Tommy and Jackie Caffrey, two little curly-headed boys dressed in sailor suits with caps to match, and the name HMS Belial printed on both. For Tommy and Jackie Caffrey were twins, scarce 4 years old, and very noisy and spoiled twins sometimes, but for all that, darling little fellows with bright merry faces and endearing ways about them. They were dabbling in the sand with their spades and buckets, building castles, as children do, or playing with their big coloured ball, happy as the day was long. And Edie Boardman was rocking the chubby baby to and fro in the pushcar, while that young gentleman fairly chuckled with delight. He was but 11 months and 9 days old, and though still a tiny toddler, was just beginning to lisp his first babyish words. Sissy Caffrey bent over him to tease his fat little plucks and the dainty dimple in his chin.
Okay. Here we begin. The three girlfriends, and notice the word friends, were seated. To be seated is not quite the same thing as being sitting. Be seated is a little bit higher, on the rocks, enjoying the evening scene and the air. And then you notice perhaps a little drop, which was fresh, but not too chilly. That's what they say, fresh, not too chilly. And I would like to point out, as usual, that kind of different elevations of language. Not everything is of the same level. Some wants to be literary and beautiful. Some is more colloquial and changes from one to the other. And that is, I think, part of the enjoyment you can get out of it. Many a time and oft, that's supposed to be literally different, many a time and oft, they were wont to come here. Now, when you say many a time and oft, often is there several times, and they're wont to, if you want to do something, you're obviously doing it several times. So there's a touch of too much, of tautology, of saying the same thing. Many in time and oft were they wont to come here to that favourite nook to have a cosy chat beside the sparkling waves and discuss matters feminine. You can see the language seems to rise and fall, sometimes colloquial, sometimes elevated. And then we have the person that we haven't met them before, Sissy Caffrey and Edie Boardman, with a baby in the pushcar. So there's and Tommy and Jackie Caffrey. So we have Sissy Caffrey with the two twin boys, and we have Needy Borden with a baby. Two little curly-headed boys dressed in sailor suits with caps to match. I realize how beautiful everything is. And the name, His Majesty's Steamship Belle Isle, printed on both. So, for Tommy and Jackie were twins, scarce 4 years old, and very noisy and spoiled twins sometimes. But for all that, darling little fellows with bright, merry faces and endearing ways about them. They were dabbling in the sand with their spades and buckets, building castles that children do, or playing with a big covered ball. Happy as a day was long. Everything's beautiful. And Edie Boardman was rocking the chubby baby to and fro in the pushcar, while that young gentleman fairly chuckled with delight. He was but 11 months and 9 days old, and, though still a tiny toddler, was just beginning to lisp his first baby's words. Mrs. Caffrey bent over him to tease his fat little flocks with her cheeks and the dainty dimple in his chin. So you can see, lovely description. Quite different from the rough tone of Cyclops.
Baby, Sissy Caffrey said, say out big, big, I want a drink of water. And baby prattled after her, a jinky jinky jobbo. Sissy Caffrey cuddled the wee chap, for she was awfully fond of children, so patient with little sufferers, and Tommy Caffrey could never be got to take his castor oil unless it was Sissy Caffrey that held his nose and promised him the scatty heel of the loaf of brown bread with golden syrup on. What a persuasive power that girl had. But to be sure, baby was as good as gold, a perfect little dote in his new fancy bib. None of your sport beauties, Flora Mac Flimsy sort, was Sissy Caffrey. A truer-hearted lass never drew the breath of life, always with a laugh in her gypsy-like eyes and a frolicsome word on her cherry-ripe red lips. A girl lovable in the extreme. And Edie Boardman laughed, too, at the quaint language of little brother. But just then, there was a slight altercation between Master Tommy and Master Jackie. Boys will be boys, and our two twins were no exception to this golden rule. The apple of discord was a certain castle of sand which Master Jackie had built, and Master Tommy would have it right go wrong that it was to be architecturally improved by a front door like the Martello Tower had. But if Master Tommy was headstrong, Master Jackie was self-willed too, and true to the maxim that every little Irishman's house is his castle, he fell upon his hated rival, and to such purpose that the would-be assailant came to grief and, alas to relate, the coveted castle too. Needless to say, the cries of discomfited Master Tommy drew the attention of the girlfriends.
Good. That's the baby. Now, baby, Sissy Caffrey said, say out big, big, I want a drink of water. Now, after all the drinking in Cyclops, you wonder what kind of Irishman this boy is. I want a drink of water. Yeah, so it's a bit of a contrast. And baby prattled after her, a jink, a jawbo, obviously learning to speak. But one of the first thing the baby said, I want a drink of water. Sissy Caffrey cuddled the wee chap, for she was awfully fond of children. So patient with little sufferers. And you can hear the Bible, let the little children, suffer the little children to come to me, things like that. And Tommy Caffrey could never be got to take his castor oil unless it was Sissy Caffrey that held his nose and promised him the scatty heel of the loaf of brown bread with golden syrup on. And here you already see a technique in this chapter that's quite important. When things get bad, you have to take castor oil, which nobody likes. You do something to take the bitterness away and you give him something sweet. That's what we all do to overcome reality and things like that. We buy ourselves a new pair of shoes, or we're reading Ulysses, or we're doing things like that. Substitute satisfactions to tide us over the bad times. What a persuasive power that girl had, and that's another thing of the chatty kind of language you get it in Dickens and everywhere. You have basically the author speaking to the audience in a sort of slightly humorous way. But to be sure, baby was as good as gold, a perfect little dote in his new fancy bib. None of your spoiled beauties, Flora McFlimsy sort. Flora McFlimsy is obviously a character in a novel, somebody who's a bit flimsy and vain and superficial. So, what's this, Caffrey? A truer hearted lass never drew the breath of life. See how many superlatives there are. Always with a laugh and her gypsy-like eyes and the frolicsome word on her cherry-red red lips. Notice the adjectives. Usually this kind of style has always beautiful, decorative adjectives. A girl lovable in the extreme. The previous chapter was extreme in, you might say, vulgarity, and this one goes the other way. And Edie Boardman laughed too at the quaint language of little brother. But things don't last. But just then there was a slight altercation between Master Tommy and Master Jackie. Boys will be boys. And our two twins were no exception to this golden rule. The apple of discord. Now, you know what the apple of discord is. I mean, it's a cliche. And it started, actually, with in Greek mythology, when there was a party of the gods, and the goddess Eris, that is strife, quarrel, was not invited. And she took an apple and threw it into the party to the most beautiful one. And so they had to decide who of the goddesses was the most beautiful. Hera, the wife of Zeus, Pallas Athene, the clever one, or Aphrodite. And they had a little shepherd boy from Troy, Prince Paris, who was the judge. That was the first beauty contest in our culture. And of course, nothing changes. They bribed him. Athene bribed him, if he chose her, he could get the most beautiful woman. And the most beautiful woman was Helen of Troy. And he went to Sparta and abducted her and took her to Troy. And that was the origin of the Trojan War, the Iliad and the Odyssey. Of course, here it's only a cliche, but that's the original thing. The apple of discord was a certain castle of sand which Master Jackie had built, and Master Tommy would have right or wrong that it had to be architecturally improved by a front door like the Martello Tower had. In Sandy Mount, where we are, there is also a Martello Tower, but it is not the Martello Tower in Sandy Cove of the first chapter. But if Master Tommy was headstrong, Master Jackie was self-willed too, and true to the maxim that every little Irishman's house is his castle, he fell upon his hated rival, and to such purpose that the would-be assailant came to grief, and, alas, to relate the coveted castle too. And you see here the theme of Cyclops, possession, fight, conflict is continued by the male twins. Needless to say, that's also a phrase that you hear very often, and you perhaps realize how stupid it is when you say, needless to say, and then you say it. The cries of discomfited Master Tommy drew the attention of the girl friends. Yep.
Come here, Tommy, his sister called imperatively at once. And you, Jackie, for shame to throw poor Tommy in the dirty sand. Wait till I catch you for that. His eyes misty with unshed tears, Master Tommy came at her call, for the big sister's word was law with the twins. And in a sad plight he was after his misadventure. His little man-o-war top and unmentionables were full of sand, but Sissy was a past mistress in the art of smoothing over life's tiny troubles, and very quickly not one speck of sand was to be seen on his smart little suit. Still, the blue eyes were glistening with hot tears that would well up, so she kissed away the hurtness and shook her hand at Master Jackie, the culprit, and said if she was near him, she wouldn't be far from him, her eyes dancing in admonition.
Come here, Tommy, his little sister called imperatively at once. And you, Jackie, for shame to throw poor Tommy into dirty sand. Wait till I catch you for that. His eyes misty with unshed tears, Master Tommy came at her call. For their big sister's word was law with the twins. And in a sad plight he was after his misadventure. His little man of war top, the sailor suit top, and unmentionables, that Victorian prudery, the trousers, pants, unmentionables, were full of sand, but Sissy was a past mistress of the art of smoothing over life's tiny troubles, and very quickly, not one speck of sand was to be seen on his smart little suit. So again, she is taking the trouble away. And soon there was not one speck of sand, there was nothing to stain it. And this is a topic that comes, remember the church is devoted to Mary, Star of the Sea. And the one thing about the Virgin Mary is she is immaculate. She is without the stain of sexual sin. And so this kind of immaculacy, stainless, comes up quite often. Still, the blue eyes were glistening and with hot tears that would well up. So she kissed away the hurtness and shook her hand at Master Jackie and the culprit and said, if she was near him, she wouldn't be far from him. That is not very great punishment. Her eyes dancing with in admonition.
Nasty bold Jackie, she cried. She put an arm around the little mariner and coaxed winningly. What's your name? Butter and cream. Tell us who is your sweetheart, spoke Edie Boardman. Is Sissy your sweetheart? No, cheerful Tommy said. Is Edie Boardman your sweetheart? Sissy queried. No, Tommy said. I know, Edie Boardman said, none too amiably, with an arch glance from her short-sighted eyes. I know who is Tommy's sweetheart. Gertie is Tommy's sweetheart. No, Tommy said, on the verge of tears. Sissy's quick mother wit guessed what was amiss, and she whispered to Edie Boardman to take him there behind the pushcar, where the gentleman couldn't see, and to mind he didn't wet his new tan shoes.
Good. So here now, nasty bold Jackie, she cried. She put an arm round the little mariner and coaxed winningly. What's your name? Butter and cream. That seems to be a nursery rhyme type of thing. Tell us, who is your sweetheart? Spoke Edie Boardman. Is Sissy your sweetheart? No, everyone said. Is Edie Boardman your sweetheart? Sissy queried. No, Tommy said. I know, Edie Boardman said, none too amiably, with an arch glance from her short-sighted eyes. I know who is Tommy's sweetheart. Gertie is Tommy's sweetheart. And now we have here Edie Boardman, who said none too amiably. Remember, the three friends were sitting on the rocks, and now it's not all that friendly between them. And you will see there's, in fact, a lot of tension. But, of course, officially, everything is okay and harmonious. And of course, she has an arch glance at something different in what she sees. Tommy, Gertie! Now, Tommy said a word of tears. Then, Sissy's quick mother had guessed what was amiss with the baby. And she whispered to Edie Boardman to take him there behind the pushcar, where the gentleman couldn't see. There must be a gentleman around. And to mind he didn't wet his new tan suit. Obviously, the baby has to do some business. Here we have the three names, and you realize that we have the typical fairy tale thing. One, two, three, and the third one is the important one. So there's a kind of fairy tale air about it. And who? Gertie McDowell. Gertie, we haven't heard it. It will now be presented. So here we have an exposition, where we are and what the persons are. And now the next thing, the focus now, is on Gertie McDowell. And you may or may not remember that we saw the name at the end of Wandering Rocks, and we even saw it in one of the interpolations of Cyclops. But of course, one doesn't remember because one of the difficulties, you don't know in this book what is worth remembering and what can be forgotten. Ultimately, I'd say, nothing is ever really forgotten, but that doesn't help us. You can't have. And now we get long paragraphs to describe, and you have this beautiful sentence, but who was Gertie? And you can recognize the style. So now we read. It's quite a long way, so I can also rest a little bit. Good.
But who was Gertie? Gertie McDowell, who was seated near her companions, lost in thought, gazing far away into the distance, was in very truth as fair a specimen of winsome Irish girlhood as one could wish to see. She was pronounced beautiful by all who knew her, though, as folks often said, she is more a Giltrap than a McDowell. Her figure was slight and graceful, inclining even to fragility, but those iron jelloids she'd been taking of late had done her a world of good, much better than the Widow Welch's female pills, and she was much better of those discharges she used to get, and that tired feeling. The waxen pallor of her face was almost spiritual in its ivory-like purity, though her rosebud mouth was a genuine Cupid's bow, Greekly perfect. Her hands were of finely veined alabaster with tapering fingers and as white as lemon juice and queen of ointments could make them, though it was not true that she used to wear kid gloves in bed or take a milk foot bath either. Bertha Supple told that once to Edie Boardman, a deliberate lie, when she was black out at daggers drawn with Gertie. The girl chums had, of course, their little tiffs from time to time, like the rest of mortals. And she told her not let on whatever she did that it was her that told her, or she'd never speak to her again. No, honour where honour is due. There was an innate refinement, a languid queenly hauteur about Gertie, which was unmistakably evidenced in her delicate hands and high-arched instep. Had kind fate but willed her to be born a gentlewoman of high degree in her own right, and had she only received the benefit of a good education, Gertie McDowell might easily have held her own beside any lady in the land, and have seen herself exquisitely gowned, with jewels on her brow and patrician suitors at her feet, vying with one another to pay their devoirs to her. Mayhap it was this, the love that might have been, that lent to her softly featured face at whiles a look tense with suppressed meaning, that imparted a strange yearning tendency to the beautiful eyes. A charm few could resist. Why have women such eyes of witchery? Gertie's were of the bluest Irish blue, set off by lustrous lashes and dark, expressive brows. Time was when those brows were not so silkily seductive. It was Madame Vera Verity, directress of the Woman Beautiful page of the Princess Novelette, who had first advised her to try eyebrow line, which gave that haunting expression to the eyes, so becoming in leaders of fashion. And she had never regretted it. Then there was blushing, scientifically cured, and how to be tall, increase your height, and you have a beautiful face, but your nose. That would suit Mrs. Dignam, because she had the button one. But Gertie's crowning glory was her wealth of wonderful hair. It was dark brown with a natural wave in it. She had cut it that very morning on account of the new moon, and it nestled about her pretty head in a profusion of luxuriant clusters and pairter nails too, Thursday for wealth. And just now, at Edie's words, as a telltale flush, delicate as the faintest rose bloom, crept into her cheeks, she looked so lovely in her sweet, girly shyness that of a surety, God's fair land of Ireland did not hold her equal.
Yeah. So you see, the style here is of women's magazines that there were there, of course, and certain novels of the kind. And you can see that Gertie is described the way women occur in the sort of things she's reading, which of course is also wish fulfillment, dreaming of a great match and all of that. And of course the language is, as you can see, sentimental, not free of kitsch, with all the trappings. So of course there's a strong, obvious note of irony. Now we have Gertie McDowell. As I said, we heard the name twice before, but may have forgotten it, who was seated near her companions, lost in thought. Lost in thought. That's also a cliche. Gazing far away into distance. And I'm sure you have seen many pictures of a woman sitting thoughtfully on the seafront and staring out into it. So it's also a pictorial cliche. She was in very truth. What is very truth? Why is very truth different from truth? And of course, very, as you all know, also means truth. So it's a little bit too much. In very truth, as fair a specimen of winsome Irish girl as one could wish to see. It's a somewhat not unqualified description. That's what you see. Next thing is what you hear. She was pronounced beautiful by all who knew her. No, and then you have a drop in the voice. As folks often said, she was more a Giltrap than a McDowell. Now, Giltrap, we may remember from the previous chapter, but there's more of it. So, and of course, often you say that the children take more after one side of the family than another. And then again, the description. Her figure was slight and graceful, inclining even to fragility. And then you get the backside, but those iron geloids she had been taking of late had done her a world of good, much better than the widow Welch's female pills, and she was much better off those discharges she used to get and the tired feeling. So you see, appearance is not quite natural, and she has to have recourse to cosmetics and to medication. That's true. So when it says the figure was slight and graceful, it might also be a bit anemic and things like that. And this is a chapter that is full of cosmetics and medication and advertisement and what you can do to improve your appearance. Like inclining, but those irons are good. And then you get the beautiful scent. The waxen pallor of her face was almost spiritual in its ivory-like purity. That's purity. Pallor, pale, spiritual, ivory-like. Why ivory-like? We'll see later. The Virgin Mary is called the Tower of Ivory, and ivory is white and blank and pure and all of that. So, though her rosebud mouth, what a genuine Cupid's bow, Greekly perfect. Now you can't have both. Either you're a very pure Catholic kind of woman, or you are have a rosebud mouth, a Cupid's bow. You know, Cupid is the god of erotic love. So it's not easy to take both. Greekly perfect. Her hands were a finely veined alabaster with tapering fingers. Tapers are also candles. And as white as lemon juice and queen of ointments, that's obviously some kind of cosmetic thing, could make them. And then, oh, it was not true. That used to have kid gloves in bed, or take a milk, football either. It's unlikely that somebody of her thing would take milk footballs. And by the way, none of these families would have had a bathroom anyway. Mm-hmm. And so you can see the tension between them. Bertha Supple told her about Edie Boardman a deliberate lie when she was black out that dagger's draw with Gertie. So not everything is good. And then, though the girl chums had, of course, their little tiffs from time to time, like the rest of mortals. And she told her naturally on whatever she did, that it was her that told her, or she'd never speak to her again. No, honour where honour is due. Then back to description. There was an innate refinement, a languid, queenly odeur. And you're out of French, of course, makes it all much better. It's also the language of fashion, of course, about Gertie, which was unmistakably evidenced by her delicate hands and high arched instep. And now she says something that is always true. Had kind fate but willed her to be born a gentlewoman of high degree, in her own right, and had she only received the benefit of a good education, Gertie McDowell might have easily have held her own beside any lady in the land and have seen herself exquisitely gowned with jewels on her brow and patrician suitors at her feet vying with one another to pay their devoirs to her. So what she says, if things had been different, they wouldn't be the same. And that's generally true. Yeah. And so she could also, and obviously her some ambitions that are totally unreal. They're no longer a young, patrician suitors to why. This is all romantic thing. It's daydreaming and wish fulfillment. By the way, there's no reason to look down on that. I think that's what we all do. We all have wishes and imagine. That's one reason why we read books, where we can be adventurous or beautiful and successful, things like that. So, there's a lot of fun, but I think there's also a lot of sympathy. Life for these people, lower middle class, wouldn't be great, so you have to make the best of it. And then another view, mayhap it was this, the love that might have been, that lent to a softly featured face at whiles a look, tense with suppressed meaning, that imparted a yearning tendency to the beautiful eyes, a charm few could resist. And then this kind of typical questions from author to reader. Why are women such eyes of witchery? Remember, eyes were also in the previous chapter, but there was only one eye that you could take away and blind. Here, it's more for seeing and for voyeurism. Gertie's eyes were of the bluest Irish blue, set off by lustrous lashes and dark, expressive brows. Time was when those brows were not so silkily seductive. That's a real advertising word, silkily seductive. And then, and here you see the reading matter behind it all. It was Madame Vera Verity. Again, there's a lot of truth in that name. Directress of the Woman Beautiful page of Princess Novelette. And Joyce used quite a lot of those female magazines. We have a few too where you find that. And of course, you probably know the reading matter that is, which by the way, though you may not notice, they're still sold in heaps in the kind of kiosks you pass by, if you only stop to look. So they are still going strong. Who had first advised her to try eyebrow line? There was such a cosmetic called eyebrow line, which gave that haunting expression to the eyes, so becoming in leaders of fashion. And yet never regretted it. Then, in these magazines, there was blushing, scientifically cured, because you don't want to blush at the wrong moment, and how to be tall, increase your height, and you have a beautiful face, but your nose. And there were such advertisements. Nowadays, it's easier to set these things right, but then you had all kinds of advertisements, things like that. That would meet Mrs. Dignam, because she had the button one. So obviously, Gertie knows the Dignams, where Bloom was. So they were in the same area, and people know each other. But Gertie's were crowning glory was a wealth of wonderful hair. It was dark brown with a natural wave in it. She had cut it that very morning on account of the new moon. A new moon had been a few days before, and I understand, but I do not understand that. I think you cut your hair often is cut in rhythm with the moon or something like that, or at least was at a certain time. Cut in the morning, count the new moon, and it nestled about her pretty head in a profusion of luxuriant clusters. And you can see how the phrase profusion of luxurious clusters could also be used to describe the style here, luxuriant clusters. And pared her nails too. You also pare your fingernails on certain occasions. Thirsty for wealth. There's a kind of superstition for every day. And of course, you're superstitious with the moon and all of that. And just now at Edie's words, because Edie has brought her up, a telltale flush, delicate as the faintest rose bloom, crept into her cheek, and she looked so lovely in her sweet girlish shyness that of a surety God's fair lamb of Ireland did not hold her equal. And we end with another delightful superlative. And now we have another long paragraph in front of us.
For an instant, she was silent, with rather sad, downcast eyes. She was about to retort, but something checked the words on her tongue. Inclination prompted her to speak out. Dignity told her to be silent. The pretty lips pouted a while, but then she glanced up and broke out into a joyous little laugh, which had in it all the freshness of the young May morning. She knew right well, no one better, what made Squinty Edie say that because of him cooling in his attentions when it was simply a lover's quarrel. As per usual, somebody's nose was out of joint about the boy that had the bicycle always riding up and down in front of a window. Only now his father kept him in the evenings, studying hard to get an exhibition in the intermediate that was on, and he was going to Trinity College to study for a doctor when he left the high school, like his brother W.E. Wiley, who was racing in the bicycle races in Trinity College University. Little red tea, perhaps, for what she felt, that dull, aching void in her heart sometimes, piercing to the core. Yet he was young, and perchance he might learn to love her in time. They were Protestants in his family, and of course Gertie knew who came first, and after him, the Blessed Virgin, and then St. Joseph. But he was undeniably handsome, with an exquisite nose, and he was what he looked, every inch a gentleman. The shape of his head, too, at the back, without his cap on, that you would know anywhere, something off the common, and the way he turned the bicycle at the lamp with his hands off the bars, and also the nice perfume of those good cigarettes, and besides, they were both of a size. And that was why Edie Wardman thought she was so frightfully clever, because he didn't go and ride up and down in front of her bit of a garden.
No. So you see slightly there's tension between them. For an instant, she was silent with rather sad, downcast eyes. She was about to retort, but something checked the words on her tongue. She was going to say something but doesn't say it. And then you have inclination prompted her to speak out. Dignity told her to be silent. That is a kind of classical sentence, you know, contrast. Inclination prompted her. Dignity told her to be silent. That is a well-formulated, basically, I think, 18th century manner. The pretty lips pouted a while, but then she glanced up and broke out into a joyous little laugh, which had in it all the freshness of a young May morning. So it's a fresh, my impression is it's a forced laugh. It's not the genuine laugh. And like, she's obviously posing because she's also under observation. She knew right well, no one better, what made squinty Edie. So Edie has arch eyes, squints a bit. Edie say that. Obviously, Edie Boardman is her opponent, not friend, because of him cooling his attention. So obviously there was something in Goethe's life, a him, unspecified so far, when he was simply a lover's quarrel. So she had obviously some kind of a boyfriend, but boyfriend is not the right word for to describe those relationships. And there was a lover's quarrel, so they had something. As per usual, somebody is no doubt out of joint. Notice how many references to noses are there. Noses are important in your face, of course. Was out of joint about the boy that had the bicycle always riding up and down in front of her window, so that she had a kind of, let's say, boyfriend who was showing off riding his bicycle in front of her window. Only now, his father kept him in the evenings studying hard to get an exhibition in the intermediate. That was on, and he was going to Trinity College to study for a doctor when he left the high school. So here there's something. He's going to Trinity College and has to study. That's a privilege to get an exhibition. Exhibition is the official name of the exams at Trinity College. But you will see in the course of the chapter that exhibition is the right word. Can't tell you. Now it is. I was going to college to study for a doctor when he left high school. Now that means something else. He's going to Trinity College, and Trinity College at that time was only for Protestants, the upper classes. And somebody like Goethe could never think of going near them. So that meant he, the boy, would also be socially out of her range and things like that. So at that time, it was strictly, in fact, one of my old friends in Dublin said he was the first Catholic to study at Trinity College. Now, of course, they can't do it anymore. So for the doctor, we had left the high school, like his brother, W.E. Wiley was racing in the bicycle race in Trinity College University. And in fact, we have read, but of course forgotten, that Reggie Wiley, the brother, was in the races that were mentioned in the 10th chapter. Little recked he, perhaps, for what she felt. So obviously she's frustrated, disappointed, and the others know it and rub it in. That dull, aching void in her heart, sometimes piercing to the cure. Yeah, pangs of love. Yet he was young, and perchance he might learn to love her in time. There's still hope. They were Protestant, his family, so that's the big thing. And of course, Goethe knew who came first. Who? Jesus Christ, of course. And after him, the Blessed Virgin, and then St. Joseph. And you know, the Blessed Virgin and St. Joseph, they have no contact to each other. Joseph is known for what he never did, and revered, that kind of thing. So it is the purity of it. But he was undeniably handsome, with an exquisite nose, and he was what he looked, every inch a gentleman. You hear Shakespeare, every inch. And the shape of his head, two at the back, without his cap, that she would know anywhere something off the common. And the way he turned the bicycle at the lamp, with his hands off the bars, and also the nice perfume of those good cigarettes. And of course, boys can, but were probably not allowed to smoke cigarettes, but it was out of question for a girl. And besides, they were both of a size. And that was why Edie Boardman thought she was so frightfully clever, because he didn't go and ride up down in front of her bit of garden. So there is a bit of jealousy. And you can see more and more how the word friends turns out not to be the ideal one. And now we have another long paragraph.
Gertie was dressed simply, but with the instinctive taste of a votary of dame fashion, for she felt that there was just a mite that he might be out. A neat blouse of electric blue, self-tinted by Dolly dyes, because it was expected in the ladies' pictorial that electric blue would be worn, with a smart V opening down to the division and kerchief pocket, in which she always kept a piece of cotton wool scented with her favourite perfume because the handkerchief spoiled the sit, and a navy three-quarter skirt cut to the stride showed off her slim, graceful figure to perfection. She wore a coquettish little love of a hat of wide-leaved nigger straw, contrast-trimmed with an underbrim of egg-blue chenille, and at the side a butterfly bow to tone. All Tuesday week afternoon she was hunting to match that chenille, but at last she found what she wanted at Cleary summer sales, the very it, slightly shop-soiled, but you never noticed, 7 figures, 2 and a penny. She did it all up by herself, and what joy was hers when she tried it on then, smiling at the lovely reflection which the mirror gave back to her. And when she put it on the water jug to keep the shape, she knew that that would take the shine out of some people she knew. Her shoes were the newest thing in footwear. Edie Boardman prided herself that she was very petite, but she never had a foot like Gertie McDowell, a 5, and never would ash, oak, or elm, with patent toe caps and just one smart buckle at her high-arched instep. Her well-turned ankle displayed its perfect proportions beneath her skirt, and just the proper amount and no more of her shapely limbs encased in fine spun hose with high-spliced heels and wide garter tops. As for undies, they were Gertie's chief care, and who that knows the fluttering hopes and fears of sweet 17, though Gertie would never see 17 again, can find it in his heart to blame her. She had 4 dinky sets with awfully pretty stitchery, 3 garments and 90s extra, and each set slotted with different coloured ribbons, rose pink, pale blue, mauve and pea green, and she aired them herself and blued them when they came home from the wash and ironed them, and she had a brickbat to keep the iron on, because she wouldn't trust those washerwomen as far as she'd see them scorching the things. She was wearing the blue for luck, hoping against hope, her own colour, and the lucky colour, too, for a bride, to have a bit of blue summer on her, because the green she wore that day week brought grief, because his father brought him in to study for the intermediate exhibition, and because she thought perhaps he might be out, because when she was dressing that morning, she nearly slipped up, the old pair on her inside out, and that was for luck and lovers' meetings, if you put those things on inside out, so long as it wasn't of a Friday. And yet...
And that's also a standard narrative technique. You present the woman or the man, what is, and then in a second or third move, what they were wearing. So that is classical style. Now, the dress. And, of course, it's a chapter about fashion. Gertie was dressed simply, but with the instinctive use a taste of votary of dame fashion. So that's the fashion chapter. For she felt that there was just the mite that he might be out. A neat blouse of electric blue, self-tinted by dolly dyes. I don't know the technical terms of these things, because it was expected in the latest pictorial that electric blue would be worn. And by the way, the color of the Virgin Mary is always blue, so she's also dressed in blue. With a smart V opening down to the division, the top, and kerchief pocket, in which she always kept a piece of cotton wool scented with her favorite perfume, because the handkerchief spoiled the scent. And the navy, that's also blue, three-quarter skirt cut to stride, show her slim, graceful figure. So the skirt is about three quarters long, so that you would see a bit of the ankle. Showed off her slim, graceful figure to perfection. Notice how perfect everything is. She wore a coquettish little love of a hat. And you hear the language of fashion that hasn't changed all that much. Cocktail hat of wide-leaf knicker straw or contra, trimmed with underbrim of egg blue chenille, must be a fabric, and at the side a butterfly bow to tone. All Tuesday afternoon, she was hunting to match the chenille, but at last she found what she wanted, a Cleary summer sale. Cleary was, it's now gone, a department store, a bit old-fashioned, and it had a summer sale where things are cheaper. They're very it, and that's a very fashion kind of, they're very it, slightly shop-soiled. And of course, as we realize, Gertie McDowell herself is no longer quite as perfect as she may seem. But you would never notice. Seven fingers to a penny. She did it up all by herself, and what joy was hers when she tried it on then, smiling at the lovely reflection which the mirror gave back to her. Looking into the mirror of the past is also a fairy tale motif, as we know. At the lovely reflection which the mirror gave back to her. And when she put it on the water jug to keep the shape, she knew that would take the shine out of some people she knew. By the way, people, women and men, were always wearing hats. Her shoes were the newest thing in footwear. Again, like a slogan. Edie Boardman prided herself that she was very petite. French is much better. But she never had a foot like Gertie McDowell, a 5. And she never rode ash, oak or elm. Must be an Irish expression. With patent toe caps, and just one smart buckle on her high arched instep. I get the impression here, but I'm not quite sure, as though she were wearing some kind of heels, which is not ideal when you go to the beach. Her well-turned ankle displayed its perfect proportions beneath her skirt, and just the proper amount, and no more, of her shapely limbs, encased in fine-spun hose. Hose is what you wear on the legs, hosiery, things like that. With high-spliced heels and wide garter tops. These are the stockings which you wouldn't see. As for undies, they were Gertie's chief care, and who that knows the fluttering hopes and fears of sweet 17, though Gertie would never see 17 again, can find it in his heart to blame her. She had 4 dinky sets with awfully pretty stitchery, 3 garments and nighties extra, and each set slotted with different coloured ribbons, rose pink, pale blue and pea green, and she aired them herself and blew them when they came home from the wash and ironed them. And she had the brickbat to keep the iron on, because she wouldn't trust those washerwomen, as far as she'd see them, scorching the things. Then she was wearing blue for luck, hoping against hope, her own colour, and the lucky colour too, for a bride. So you see her ambitions to have a bit of blue somewhere on her. Because the green she wore that day week brought grief. Because his father brought him in to study for the immediate exhibition. And because she thought perhaps he might be old. Because when he was dressing that morning, she nearly slipped up the old pair and into that. And that was for luck. And lovers meeting, if you put those things on inside out, so long as it wasn't on a Friday. There's a lot of superstitions on what you wear and all that. Now, that's perhaps the point, the time to talk about the background in Homer. Chapter Joyce named Nausicaa. The following happening. Remember, Odysseus was freed by the gods. He was sent on a raft by Calypso, but the float wrecked, and he had to swim ashore, and he stayed in the bushes among the Phaeacians. This was a kind of an area that is no longer quite fairy tale, but also not quite, so in between the horror stories and all of the adventures and the real world. Now, he was quite alone. He had nothing. He had nothing, no credit card, of course, no phone, no money, no clothes. And he was entirely dependent on human help. Now, his protectress, Pallas Athene, she was masterminding everything. She's really the hero of the Odyssey. She sends a dream to young Princess Nausicaa and says, you are growing up and you will soon find a husband, and in order to be prepared, you have to go and wash your underclothes and all of that. So you should do that in the morning. And then she asks her father, and then she drives to with her companions. She drives to the beach where they wash the clothes. Princesses did that and dry the clothes. And to pass the time, they were playing with a ball and throwing it around. At one point, they miss and they begin to scream. And here, and that's a great moment in the Odyssey, and here Odysseus wakes up with nothing on, and here, and there, here, as you can see, a group of young girls, and he has to come, approach them, because he needs human help, and goes, and Joyce made a point of it, and Odysseus breaks a twig from the near bushes to hide certain parts of his body. And so he slowly approaches the girl, a little bit uncomfortable, as who would not be, and he thinks to himself, should I go close to her and kneel down and touch her knees, which was the usual thing, or should I stand at a distance and use honeyed words, sweet words. And he repeats that, said it's maybe better to stand at a distance and speak with her. And that's what he then does. And he speaks so beautifully. He says, are you a goddess or thing? And he flatters her so much that she is enthralled. And she says, let's wash him. He was still dirty. Give him clothes and all of the dresses. The companions have scattered aside. And then she dresses him and tells him to go to town. They don't go together. It was her reputation. And go to the king and the queen and ask for asylum, a shelter, and that happens, and he is well received and stays there for a few days. So that is what it is. Now, it goes on then. There are quite a few songs in there where they have all kinds of sports and entertainment. And finally, Odysseus goes to the court. They don't know who he is, but he finally tells them who he is, and it's at this point in the Odyssey, books 5, 6, books 9 to 12, where he tells all his adventures. That's what we know about the Odyssey. And then they give him thing and send him home. Now, of course, Nausicaa is obviously falls in love with the handsome, though no longer quite young man. And I'm quite sure in Homer it is already a kind of inverted, frustrated love story, because you know the pattern. I mean, that must have happened often, that there's a king in disguise, and he comes, and of course he sees the young king's daughter there, and they would ultimately marry and all of that. And here this pattern does not take place, and she's quite disappointed, cast down, and she says to him, by the way, don't forget me, remember I saved your life and all of it. So it is a kind of a love story that does not come off. I mentioned that indeed because that is in a way the equivalent here. So we read a bit and then I'll tell you to stop at a certain point.
That strained look on her face. A gnawing sorrow is there all the time. Her very soul is in her eyes, and she would give worlds to be in the privacy of her own familiar chamber, where, giving way to tears, she could have a good cry and relieve her pent-up feelings, though not too much, because she knew how to cry nicely before the mirror. You are lovely, Gertie, it said. The palely light of evening falls upon a face infinitely sad and wistful. Gertie MacDowell yearns in vain. Yet, yes, she had known from the first that her daydream of a marriage has been arranged, and the wedding bells ring for Mrs. Reggie Wiley, TCD, because the one who married the elder brother would be Mrs. Wiley, and in the fashionable intelligence, Mrs. Gertrude Wiley was wearing a sumptuous confection of grey trimmed with expensive blue fox, was not to be. He was too young to...
I think we stop here, yeah. Good. By now we know the language, and yet, that strained look in her face, on her face, annoying sorrow is there all the time. Her very soul is in her eyes, and she would give worlds to be in the privacy of her own familiar chamber. She would give worlds. Now, she doesn't have to give worlds, she could just go home. So it's that kind of exaggeration. To be in the private only chamber, giving way to tear, she could have a good cry and relieve her pent-up feelings. Though not too much, because she knew. You often find here the word because, which doesn't really explain very much. Because she knew how to cry nicely before the mirror. And again, you have a fairy tale looking in the mirror, who is the most beautiful. You are lovely, Gertie, it said. Then the pale light of evening falls upon a face infinitely sad and wistful. And you see, you can read this pathetically, to bring out the full value of it. Gertie MacDowell yearns in vain. And the next sentence that's coming, I'm always emphasizing, it is what I would call the syntactic institution of frustration by words and by syntax. Yes, she had known from the first that her daydream of a marriage... She obviously dreams of marriage. I mean, that's usually the substance of all the story, get the man. And one has to say something else here that's important. Obviously, Gertie MacDowell is not from the upper classes. she has, you know, she buys things at the summer sale, a bit chopsoiled and all of it. And this has to do with the situation of Irish women, if they weren't well off, the majority of them. There weren't many opportunities. There weren't many jobs. You could be in domestic service, but that must have been awful. And I can only imagine how much they must have suffered and been humiliated and all of that. I'm glad that is. If you were educated, you could probably teach. There wasn't much office work. And as we know from Dubliners, if you did get a husband, that was often not very much. The husbands, when they got their salary, they didn't bring it home. They went to the pub and had to be forced home by the children and all of that. So it is grim. And you could join a monastery, a convent. That was a living. Or at the worst, you could go in the streets. So the chances of marriage were rather slim. And moreover, for economic reasons, the Irish men married fairly late. And if you were after 17 and the early 20s, if you didn't find a husband soon enough, you've had it. And so there's a grim background to all of this. For all the kind of irony that we can see, it wasn't easy, and they were desperate to find somebody. And you know, in the Dublin stories, how many couples were not very happy then, even if they had. So this is, in a way, the background. But now, the ambition. Yes, she had known from the start that her daydream of a marriage, and now in English you can easily slip into a new sentence, her daydream of a marriage has been arranged. This is now the wish fulfillment. And the wedding bell rings for Mrs. Reggie Wiley, TCD. If she were to marry Reggie Wiley, her official title would be Mrs. Reggie Wiley, TCD, the degree from Trinity College, Dublin. But she would have her husband's name and attributes, if she ever did. And then it explained, because the one who married the elder brother would be Mrs. Wiley. So there's a kind of naming convention. And she would only be Mrs. Reggie Wiley and not Mrs. Wiley. And in the fashionable intelligence, as you know how important it is to have the wedding reported in the newspaper. They still do that all the time. And in the fashionable intelligence, Mrs. Gertrude Wiley was wearing a sumptuous confection. And of course, they always say what the bride is wearing, and that's one of the climaxes of their life. A sumptuous confection. And again, you realize the language we have here is full of sumptuous confections. Of grey trimmed with expensive blue fox. So that's in a way the climax. And I think in the meantime, we've almost forgotten that it's only a daydream. And when you have expensive blue fox, what not to be? And certainly we fall out of the sky and come back to earth. And I think for a while we were really misled into this imaginary climax, and here we come out and come down to earth with a bump. And that, I think, is a good place also to stop, because we can't do the rest of it, and so we take on from here next time. So you see, it's something quite different, a soft tone, and again, of course, we have learned in the meantime to read between the lines and find out that it's not a very beautiful friendship, but there's quite a lot of envy and jealousy and tension and bitterness and spite and all of that. So that is, but it's an easy chapter to read, you know. There's not much that you have to explain. You could easily you could read this on your own, more or less. And I can just add a few touches. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed that chapter 2. It's a relief after all the noise and swearing and bloody of Cyclops. Good. Have a nice week then, Yoko.
Thank you. You
Thank
too.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.